Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:30 p.m. that is Central Time. Today is April 5th. I thought we'd kick off with a little bit of history. And when you look at this overlay chart of the ECB's balance sheet in white and bond yields in orange, we can see there that back in 2012, the balance sheet of the ECB had jumped from 2 to 3 trillion euro. And they did that in a short period of time because they were responding to the threat from the global financial crisis, and it was considered necessary. And there were still, at the time, fears about what that would do to inflation. So the ECB moved with alacrity, and by the time 2013 had rolled into 2014, they had taken all that money out of circulation. And initially, bond yields went up, but soon afterwards, then bond yields collapsed, going from approximately 2% to zero. So that was a really profound move, which coincided with the period of quantitative tightening. And it was, in retrospect, easy to understand why. Quantitative tightening in Europe contributed to deflation. There were deflationary fears right across the Eurozone, and it was in large part due to the fact that the ECB was sucking liquidity out of the economy, and global growth wasn't really anything to write home about at the time. So Europe was really under a lot of stress. And then, of course, you had the sovereign wealth crisis on top of that, and the banking sector was in a mess. So there was a lot of different factors that were contributing to that deflationary environment, but quantitative tightening certainly wasn't helping. So that was one example of what we could see from quantitative tightening. Now, we also have the same environment with the Federal Reserve. Back in 2018, the Federal Reserve was worried that asset prices were becoming overvalued and that animal spirits were becoming a little bit too aggressive. So they had been raising rates and simultaneously withdrawing liquidity from the balance sheet. And they took 750 billion out of circulation. Initially, bond yields went up, and subsequently, bond yields collapsed. So, what this tells us is we've got two examples now of what to anticipate when we get quantitative tightening. And it contributes to deflationary forces. We had outright deflation in the Eurozone, and we had the clear fear of a recession and slowing growth in 2019. Then we had tightening liquidity contributing to a problem in the high yield market, and then subsequently the repo market seizing up. And that reversed course for the Federal Reserve. They had to then start re-injecting liquidity into the market, and exactly like what we've seen from the ECB, every time quantitative tightening has been tried, it's led to deflation, and then subsequently, the size of the balance sheet has had to multiply in order to compensate for those deflationary forces. So, I think those are important precedents to keep in mind as we look at what's happening now. So, let's think then about what's happening in terms of the Federal Reserve and 10-year treasuries right now. Because the 10-year treasury yield is still trending higher, and it was up in a dynamic manner in here today and closing at a new recovery high. This is a really aggressive advance, and it's overbought or overextended in the short term. There is no question of that, and it has to be also viewed in the context of Federal Reserve committee that seemed to be very eager to withdraw liquidity from the market and to do so in a more aggressive manner this time than they did last time. Well, That means that we're going to look at liquidity becoming less available, financial conditions becoming tighter. And it does beg the question whether they are going to even have to raise interest rates. I think there's a solid argument that quantitative tightening is probably going to do the job of interest rate hikes much better than interest rate hikes would. If inflation was caused by rampant money creation, well, then it stands to reason that taking that money out of circulation is something that would help to mitigate some of those inflationary pressures. Now, money growth is still running at about 11%. That's down a lot from the 25 plus percent at the beginning of 2021, but it's still high by historical standards, which is a good reason why we've had a lot of interest in trying to buy dips, substantial rebounds from short-term oversold conditions, because monetary policy, even at this much reduced level, is still running way above any point at any point where money growth was high between 1983 and 2020. But that money growth is coming down, and it is likely to continue to contract. So this is suggesting that we're going to have a continued uptrend in government bond yields for a while. And then subsequently, growth will slow. Inflation will start to ebb, and bond yields will then collapse. So when we then think about the bond prices, we've had a really profound decline, and they are exceptionally oversold. And they're still going down, and down another point in here today, coming back down into the region of the lows from 2018. There's the possibility that those lows will be exceeded, that we might even come back down into the lows of 2008. Now, looking at long-term prices of bonds, it's not particularly fruitful because of coupon changes. As futures move one into the other, they create big steps in the chart. But we haven't had a lot of interest rate hikes over the course of the last few years, so we don't have the big steps that we would normally see. If we go back then and look at, for example, these kinds of steps, we haven't had a lot of them. And it's a very oversold condition, and accelerations are trend endings. And this trend has been going on for 2 years already, and it's not over. But ultimately, if the Federal Reserve goes ahead and follows through on its promise to accelerate the pace of quantitative tightening, then by the end of this year, we're going to have sharp deflationary forces. And the stock market is beginning to price that in. So the Nasdaq was down 1% and a bit in here today. It's still pausing here in the region of the 200-day moving average. And we've unwound about half of the decline from the peak in November. And this is really the first area of potential resistance. If I've been rather vocal in saying that I thought that the Federal Reserve would raise rates and it would be a one-and-done scenario. Well, that conviction is probably not going to be correct because it does look like they're going to raise rates again in May. But I remain very much of the view that the number of interest rate hikes is going to be rather small, but that perhaps the pace of quantitative tightening will be much faster than we've seen in the past. And if that's the case, it's going to suck liquidity out of the system. And during 2018 and 2019, well, the stock market didn't do especially well. We had a 10% pullback at the beginning of 2018 and a 20% pullback at the end of 2018. And now we've had a good sized pullback on the Nasdaq. I still think that it is more likely than not that we're going to see it come all the way back down to test the region of the 1,000-day moving average. And if it does in fact occur, that's probably going to be a catalyst for the Federal Reserve to stop raising rates, or to be at least much less aggressive in terms of raising rates. But they might still continue to reduce the size of the balance sheet if inflation doesn't also come back down. Now, when we look at the more defensive portion of the market, the Dow Jones was down less in here today. It did reverse an earlier advance and was in negative territory, and it's also in the region of the 200-day moving average. But there is a clear preference in the market right now by investors for income-producing assets. So blue chips certainly fall into that category. And investors are both paying up for yield, but also favoring reliability of paying those dividends. So the Dividend Aristocrats were not immune from selling pressure in here today, but still continue to exhibit relative strength. Now, we've also continued to see increasing stress on the geopolitical front. And there are portions of the there sorry portions of the commodity markets which are again accelerating. So jet fuel has been ramping higher over the last few weeks. Oil prices are still holding the region of $100. Now, they were in negative territory in here today, but not in an especially dynamic manner. And however, it's also quite clear that oil prices are unlikely to be able to sustain very high prices if we see growth starting to ebb, because that would hit demand. And a lot of the advance that we've seen in oil has been about supply. And if demand were to begin to moderate, well, then that would have a negative impact on commodity pricing. So I suspect that what we can anticipate from commodities is some volatility. And copper prices were also in negative territory in here today. And there's been a range underway now for a year. It still has a sequence of higher reaction lows, but it does look likely that it's going to come back and test those lows. So I think what we have to be prepared for is additional volatility overall, and the acceleration we're seeing in bond yields supports that view. Well, let's just think a little bit about the epicenter of risk. So it would be easy to assume that Europe represents the epicenter of risk because of its proximity to Ukraine and Russia, and the dependence of Europe on Russian energy. Both oil and gas, as well as coal, are major imports by Europe from Russia. And with the atrocities that are becoming public as Russia pulls out from the environs of Kiev, well, that's just going to enhance the potential that additional sanctions will be levied. So natural gas prices have contracted significantly in the UK and are now in the region of the 200-day moving average. It's a level where we might anticipate some support starting to come back in. It's also, I think, worth thinking about the fact that we haven't really seen any commodities giving up all of the advances. So this looks like a new plateau for natural gas prices. In other words, a step higher in terms of costs for everyone. When we think about risk, well, Europe trades on a lower valuation, and there are certainly problems that need to be addressed, particularly in the energy sector. And there's a good reason then why Europe is becoming progressively more interested in energy independence. So that's going to be beneficial for renewable energy because it delivers energy independence. It might be intermittent supply, but at least it's domestic. But perhaps the bigger risk for markets is the fact that the tech sector in the US is really overvalued. And we've already seen a big decline for some of the unprofitable companies. And the ARK Innovation ETF, it tried to break its sequence of lower rally highs last week, finished weaker, and is pulling back again in here today. I think it's quite likely that these unprofitable companies are going to be the ones that find it most difficult to find support. If your company doesn't have profits and is or has attained a market cap in the billions, or tens of billions, even hundreds of billions, then you need liquidity. You need the liquidity to fund growth, marketing, pay wages. And it's basically talking about a run rate. Well, that persists indefinitely as long as there's additional liquidity coming through and you can achieve your growth targets. But in a rising interest rate environment where liquidity becomes less available, then that business model fails. So we're certainly in an environment where there is more risk in the unprofitable portion of the market, and where we've seen the major declines and now starting to see resistance coming through in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. What we're presented with here is the potential that we could be looking at the beginning of lengthy base formations. Now, I suspect we're going to get some additional volatility, and that's likely to create buying opportunities for the better performing assets that are going to both benefit from increasing spending going forward, both to achieve energy independence and to comply with the rising tide of climate legislation. We definitely had a strongly worded suite of statements coming through in here this week from the International Panel on Climate Change, basically saying that time hasn't quite run out, but people will have to get really busy really quickly if the goals set by the Paris Agreement are going to be met. But what they're really saying is that there's no way that those goals are going to be met, and that there's no sign of any action really to contain or to reduce carbon emissions. So what we should really be preparing for is a rise in the temperature of at least 3 degrees. Carbon emissions pulled back sharply at the beginning of this year following the invasion and then subsequently rebounded. But it's hard to imagine why those carbon emission prices should come down when Europe isn't going to abandon the carbon emissions trading regime. Now, they're going to need to do a lot of investing in new energy and particularly to champion energy independence. But they're not going to sacrifice their commitment to climate goals at this in order to achieve that. So that says to me, at least, that we've probably seen the low for carbon emissions, and they're unlikely to trade back below 60, and that there's the real possibility that they might even trend higher from here. Then we have what's going on in China. So we have a lot of different challenges in the global economy right now. The Chinese market was closed the last couple of days. Now, it was steadying last week, but they had 13,000 new cases of COVID in Shanghai today. So they're going to lock down the entire city, and nobody's going to be able to go to work. Nobody's going to be able to leave their home. And we've seen what hard lockdowns look like in China, where people get welded into their apartments. So they're going to get in control of the outbreak in Shanghai. But it probably means that Shanghai is going to be shuttered for at least the next month. And they have similar problems in Fujian and Jilin. So this, and then they have a new variant which is perhaps even more transmissible. So China definitely has problems right now, and it's hard to think how they're going to be able to achieve anything close to their growth or their stated growth rate without significantly boosting stimulus and then potentially further devaluing the currency. And Japan has no notion of abandoning its yield curve control. So they're printing money. They're one of the few central banks that continues to be wedded to its quantitative easing program. That's helping to support the nominal value of Japanese shares. The yen was really very oversold, so we've had some steadier action over the last week. But now the dollar is regrouping, so the yen is weakening once more, and it does look likely that it will take out the 125 area. So then hedged exposure to Japanese equities is probably going to start becoming more fashionable again. Then Europe doesn't really want to raise interest rates. They feel like they're going to have to, but they're not going to hurry at it. So the euro is coming back down again, having got up to test the 111 area. This is still a downtrend overall. And of course, if the US dollar, or I guess if the Federal Reserve is serious about quantitative tightening, then that reduces the supply of dollars. So the dollar should be firm in that environment. Now, gold prices were in positive territory earlier on today, gave it up, and are finishing out the day in negative territory. There's been an inert range underway for the last 3 weeks. There are two arguments in any range because supply and demand come back into at least temporary equilibrium. So the bullish argument is that central banks have walked themselves into a corner and they're not going to be able to raise rates. So therefore, gold is a positive beneficiary because the purchasing power of currencies is going to be devalued and it will rise as a result. Then the bearish case is that bond yields are rising, that the bond market is pricing in 9 interest rate hikes this year, so 8 more, and that's a headwind for gold. And because we haven't had action either one way or the other, then we're still in this ranging environment. I'm very much of the view that the Federal Reserve will not be able to raise rates like they want to. So that's bullish for gold. But at the same time, we certainly have had a big move higher in yields. But I do think that, as we've seen from other quantitative tightening programs, that those yields are going to start coming back down. That will then ram home the point that central banks are in no position to try and raise rates, at which point gold would surge higher. So I continue to think that this is just a consolidation, and that it is more likely than not that gold is going to be pushing up and out of this range before the end of the year. And there's the real potential that bonds are going to rally in a big way when growth really does show evidence of moderating. And that's probably going to be within the next 2 quarters. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.